on X-rays and gamma rays part of the electromagnetic spectrum?
Yes, some of those are ionizing radiation, but RF is not. RF, by definition, ends in the gigahertz range, long before there is any kind of breaking of any bonds.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I just wonder, you know, if there have been studies on how many different frequencies and wattage and proximity to your body, how much damage it could cause, and basically what is found in nature.
Well, I mean, the most dangerous electromagnetic waves that are found in nature are, for the most part, ultraviolet. I mean, there's little gamma radiation by the time you get to the ground. When you're flying in a plane, you're exposed to significant more gamma radiation, which can increase your risk of developing cancer down the road. There's been loads of studies and more studies and even more studies, and still people are quite paranoid when it comes to cell towers, cellular phones, even though they do operate in the non-ionizing gigahertz range. But that doesn't stop people from thinking that, you know, there's a group of people who still think that the COVID vaccine was built with graphene nanotechnology so that 5G signals could control and turn us into zombies. So there's all kinds of mishigas out there, but there have been a lot of studies on the problems at different frequencies. And as I mentioned before, if you stay below the ionizing radiation, most impact is local burns and thermal issues, not really anything serious. When you get up to the energy of UV light and above, you start to have degradation and destruction of DNA that can cause mutations and occasionally will produce a cancerous type of a cell. So there's lots of study, and they'll continue to do studies, especially because they'll continue to have people who will refuse to let cell towers within a mile of their homes.
Certainly understand that. I always wanted to know what would be the problematic issues caused by standing 10 feet away from a 50,000 watt radio transmitter.
Again, it's primarily thermal. You know, your eyeball might get overheated, but it's not going to give you cancer. And give you local burns if there's any arcing that goes on. You know, I mean, the FCC has required all amateur radio operators to plug in the specs of their shack, their distance that people stand from their radiating antennas, the gain of their antenna, the output of their transmitter to their antenna, the attenuation of their antenna systems, transmission lines and such, to see if there is a significant risk of exposure to RF waves. And you're supposed to do that, I think, sometime in the next 6 years, because I think it went to effect about 3-4 years ago. So there is that. So you can look it up. The ARRL has a little worksheet that you can plug in, and it'll give you the risk of your present setup.
We'll do that. Does lead stop gamma radiation?
It attenuates it. As I often say, it's not a binary one and zero. There are things that attenuate other things. That doesn't mean that they stop 100%. They might stop 90%. They might stop 99%, depending upon the dimensions of the lead. A thin sheet of lead will not be terribly good at attenuating gamma rays, whereas a couple of feet thick of lead will be excellent for most cases. But again, if you walk into a box that's a couple of feet of lead-lined material and set off a hydrogen bomb next door, you're going to be vaporized. So it can only attenuate so much.
Curious. Has there ever been a study on pilots who have been flying for like 35, 40 years and seeing the incidence of cancers and other radiation-induced maladies?
I'm kind of sure that they have because that's not terribly difficult. Airplane companies keep records, so you can figure out. And the pilots, I'm sure, themselves keep records of how much airtime they have. So it's probably been done a bunch of times. And my guess is that it shows a increase. It's not a death sentence. It's not a sure thing. But I'm sure, as far as probabilities are concerned, if you spend a very significant portion of your life at high altitudes where there's less absorption of astronomical gamma rays, it's not a good thing.
Would an astronaut have the most exposure?
Well, it would be a worse situation because they would be exposed to far more radiation depending upon the shielding of their spaceship. The positive is that they would probably spend significantly less time up there than the average guy who's flying a plane as a living does.
I wonder if there's any other substance besides lead that would be a better, a better material to go ahead and absorb or reflect gamma rays.
It's not quite as much a case of reflecting, it's just absorbing, and it has to do with the density. Lead is a relatively dense material. It's easy to, it's available all over the place. You can roll it into any shape or size that you want. There are denser elements, so you can make, instead of lead shields, you could make, say, tungsten shields, which probably have a little bit better gamma ray absorption. But they would be a lot more expensive. So people kind of settled with lead as the least expensive and best a compromise type of situation to use.
Curious. If you have a pound of lead and you bury it 5 feet underground, how long does it take for it to actually spread electrically?
Sort of depends upon the environment that you're burying it in. Under some circumstances, it could be relatively inert. If it's acidic soil, then you'll have the acid slowly decaying it into lead minerals. So it ultimately depends on the environment. It depends upon the average moisture it receives. All kinds of, secondary type of, variables determine how long it stays in that particular form before it basically dissolves into some mineral.
Okay, very well. I'm going to be on for another 5 more minutes, and then I'm going to go QRT. Maybe there's some other people out there that would like to get into the game.
I have a question.
Scott?
You whole guys have started what was before the band.
Okay.
So, for me, that was the time is a space-time that created accumulation of the energy in one point. So there is an issue between creationists and materialists in this matter. Dr. Ray.
okay? I mean, it isn't particularly space-time. It's sort of gotten to the field of quantum field theory, that all of space is full of different quantum fields. The electromagnetic field, the strong nuclear force field, the weak nuclear force field, and some aspect of gravity, although it's kind of problematic. Quantum gravity is a real woolly thing, but there are different fields with different fluctuating fields, and those fluctuating fields can get disturbed and destabilized. And so the theory was that there was some great destabilization since at the very beginning of time. There was no time. You can't kind of say, well, you know, how long did it last, and what happened, when did one thing lead to another? Because you're by default defining the start time to when the imbalance occurs. Anything before the imbalance is before time from our reference point. So it doesn't really help to discuss it because it doesn't really mean much. Creationists just kind of go to a magic man, which I guess is an easy thing to do, but terribly unrewarding. They went to the magic man for gravity and for motion and for all kinds of things, and we had absolutely nonsense going on, the Dark Ages and such. So, you know, going to a magic man with a points his finger and says, let it be, doesn't really get you very far. You know, I mean, if you want to settle for that, then fine. That's wonderful. But there's no going past that. Then you're just kind of sitting there and saying, okay, let's all kind of pick up hammers and bang ourselves.
Well, I have a problem with quantum gravity you mentioned. Because for me it is a theoretical physics field that seeks to describe gravity in sort of principles of quantum mechanics. It deals with environments in which neither gravitational nor quantum effects could be ignored, such as I've been saying, to black holes or similar astrophysical objects like the neutron stars, but before the Big Bang, there was none of that. So I don't know how you just put it into it.
Well, I mean, even physicists have lots of problem with quantum gravity, and no one really understands it. And, you know, if you listen to enough people who are kind of at the edges of trying to figure something out, you'll hear a lot of talk about, you know, space, different coordinates and different geometries of space and all manner of things, string theory, brain theory, G-theory, it goes all over the damn place. So you're not the only one who has problems with quantum gravity. Quantum characteristics kind of do well to explain everything but gravity. Relativity kind of is ultimately explaining gravity, but you can't kind of hit both of them and kind of build something based on both of them together. There are two ways of looking at the universe, so it's very difficult to merge relativity and quantum mechanics, and so you're stuck with the problem that quantum gravity is a mystery to the most brilliant theoretical physicists in the world. A lot of them seemingly are wasting a lot of time with supersymmetry and string theory and string theory's variance. And, you know, de Sitter space, anti-de Sitter space, I could wax poetic over what these guys talk about day in and day out that would give all of you a severe headache. But, I mean, quantum gravity, lots of luck. Maybe if we reconvene this 100 years from now, we'll have a better understanding of quantum gravity, but I don't think it's going to change much in the next few years.
Yeah, thank you very much for that explanation. If we take the four fundamental forces of nature, what is it, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, the electromagnetic interaction, the strong force, and the weak force. So that leaves the gravity as only in direction that has not been fully accommodated, but before Big Bang there was no gravity at all. So my understanding that in this point, would you please correct me, popping particles into life and disappearing could be seen as the mechanism of disturbance before the Big Bang. And then accumulation of energy came from that. What do you think?
Well, again, there's fundamentally no real theory before the Big Bang. As far as physicists are concerned at this level, except for kind of just making up stuff like hyper universes, multiverses, and such that coexist on hyper-dimensional, 11-dimensional axes and such. Unless you want to babble about that nonsense, as far as most physicists who talk about the Big Bang, time began at the beginning of the Big Bang. And so it is meaningless to say what happened before, because there wasn't any before that we know of that we can prove. So that's not true about how gravity came into existence after the Big Bang, but wasn't there before. No one says that. No one that I know says that. And you got the four interactions of physics wrong. The four interactions of physics are the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, and gravity. Those are the four fundamental interactions of physics. And there is quantum field theory for both the electromagnetic and the weak nuclear force, and there is good theory for close to the beginning of the universe when things were much hotter and the forces were symmetrical. There's something called the electroweak force, which is the electromagnetic and the weak nuclear force kind of broke symmetry. It was the last of the two interactions to break symmetry and produce two different things. And that's just the way physicists understand it. It's the strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force, and gravity. And although quantum can handle everything but gravity, when it comes to gravity, they don't really know. They use terms like gravitons, which are particles of gravity-carrying characteristics, but there's no good math under it, and they just keep pointing to string theory and hope for the best.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much for correcting me. So I didn't voice properly, so I was trying to say that within the framework of quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, then we have the electromagnetic interaction, strong force, weak force, and the gravity. Back to you.
And unfortunately, Stephen Hawking made a wonderful explanation for Hawking's radiation, which used a very sophisticated, brilliant, special case for quantum gravity that you couldn't use for generally any other aspect of quantum gravity. He won awards on that, and unfortunately, because it's too complicated to write into a popular book on the subject, he basically lied about the cause for Hawking's radiation in his popular books and made millions from it. So, what can I tell you? He made a lot of money. So, I guess he won.
Yes, as far as I remember, the current understanding of gravity is based on Albert Einstein. General theory of relativity, which incorporates his theory of special relativity and modifies the understanding of concepts like time and space. But if you could say in few words, in condensed form, what is your understanding? What was it before the Big Bang?
Well, again, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Again, according to most physicists, they have nothing to say about before the Big Bang because that's where time is zero. So when time is -3, what does that mean? And they will tell you, we don't know. So I can't really tell you anything. already before the Big Bang. Gravity itself is, again, a fascinating thing that might give some people headaches. It has to do, ultimately, with time dilation. As you get closer to a distortion of space-time, time dilates. And there is, everyone knows momentum, you know, motion times velocity, and momentum is conserved. So, you know, at the end, you got to do something either with the motion and the velocity. It has to either remain the same or you have to use a force upon it to change it. So there's also something called the four momentum, which is space-time momentum. So that if you go through some kind of time dilation, you have to have some kind of a reactive force kind of conserving your four momentum, and we feel that that four momentum conservation as a force acting on us, and we call it gravity. So it's an aspect of time dilation due to space-time distortion. I hope I haven't given anyone a headache.
So you actually agree that it was a disturbance, some sort of disturbance that took place before the energy started to accumulate in one point?
I don't know. We keep on having this disagreement. We cannot describe anything about a universe before the Big Bang. The Big Bang is the beginning of the universe. If you want to kind of play games and say that there's a multiverse, and the multiverse had things going on, and there are 11 play axes of dimensions in the multiverse, and this universe is kind of stuck on four of that space-time, and that others coexist on different axes. But again, you know, it's non-provable, non-falsifiable. It's just staring at your belly button at this point.
Did you ever ask yourself the question?
Yes.
I just want to wish a very interesting dialogue tonight, and I want to wish everybody a happy and safe Labor Day. This is KF2ZZ going QRT, and I'm clear. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Brian. Thanks again. Have a great Labor Day. Wes, I think we got to wrap this up because Paul's in the wings waiting to talk. So, again, I thank you very much. Gave me an opportunity to expound on all kinds of stuff that I find intriguing that I hope I haven't bored too many people with.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and attention and to experience.
Very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Kings County News Game. This is the Limemark Technical Net, and it is now time for the Space Net with Paul WS2N.
Hi, Business Roy, AC2GS WS2N for the Space Net report for the TechNet. And, you get Kings County guys coming in, right? Very good. And okay, on that Brookhaven story, you know, they are building another detector out there for the RIC program. And I thought maybe you're going to be talking about that, but they have other things out there at Brookhaven. But the big one is the RIC program. That's the one that goes around 2.5 miles. It's a big, gigantic circle. And the circumference. And that's the relativistic heavy ion collider that they have, and that's been operating since the that was being built in the late 80s. So I was out there, I installed some pipes in one of these detector areas for a contractor out there. That was a fun job, found out about the RIC program. And then they had, like I said, a couple of different detectors that they used over the years. But now they're putting a new one in. And this one has to do with, I think I read gluons or something that looks for gluons. We'll have to read about it. But, you know, it's not ready yet, but they're working on it, right? Just, I'll have to keep my ears open for that detector at Rick, at Brookhaven Lab.
K2SCP.
Good evening, Chris. How are you?
Good, Paul. Thank you. Hope you're doing well as well. Just a quick question before you get going. I noticed this afternoon I saw a story. I don't know if you're going to cover this about the Starliner up on the space station making a strange noise out of the speakers, and they were communicating back to Houston and back and forth. They were playing audio of it, and it sounded like a strange sound. They couldn't figure it out. I wonder if you heard about it or you're going to talk about it.
My wife sent me the story when she read about it, and then I followed up on it, and it's more than one website that now has that story. So I guess it's the noise they're hearing from Starliner. Apparently, it's coming out of a speaker. Butch Wilmore was hearing it while he was floating around inside of Starliner, and. They figured out it was some kind of a sound like a ping noise, according to mission control, like you would have in a sonar noise, you know. So it was repetitious. I don't know if it's there all the time. I don't know what frequency it is. So I'm looking for some kind of maybe there's a half a dozen computers on board Starliner, and maybe one of them is acting up and getting RF out, and who knows, it could be being picked up by a speaker. And I don't know if it could be one of the transmitting gadgets on the outside of the space station, you know, that they might have. Maybe that's putting out some kind of interference. They're going to look into it. I was hoping that they would take that audio, Chris, and you know, put it on the air so I could hear it. Back to you, Chris.
But yeah, somehow I knew you would have seen it already, Paul. It's on YouTube. You can hear the sound as it was relayed back to Houston, and then the guys talking about it. And they actually key up twice in the Starliner with the sound in the background. You can clearly hear it. And yeah, it sounds, it's a repetitious, some kind of electronic noise. But I got the feeling it was like a failing motor or something, a vacuum pump or something like that, which could be, pretty detrimental to them, obviously. But, I'll be interested to find out what the heck this is. K2SPP, thanks, Paul.
Oh, good. I'll have to look for that. That's what I was hoping to hear. Now they have it on YouTube. I'll find that. And some kind of a pump failure. You know, they have the service module bolted up behind them. And that's what they get all there. Human needs from that service monitor and air and stuff like that. So, yeah, it could be something like that. A failure with a mechanical device that could be failing. But they said the noise was coming out of the speaker. Are they still confirming that, or has that been changed?
No, that's what the astronaut who relayed the message. She said it is coming out of the speaker, and they. Made sure that he confirmed that for them, and he did, floating around in there, and he could tell it's some kind of electronic noise, but pretty interesting. I'll email to the mailbag the link to it, you know, to search for it, but it's a one-minute clip, you know, hear them talking about it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, if you put it on Roy.ac2gs, that would be great. Well, definitely look for that. Creeped up today. And that's astronaut is Butch Wilmore. He's one of the stranded ones. Him and his partner that went up, Sonny Williams. She's the one with the call letters. But they're both test pilots. And they're going to be very happy that they stay another 6 months, a total of 8 months up there. Now that they've decided that they will not be coming back on Starliner. Starliner will come back on it by itself now. I think they said 12:03 or something. Here's a predicted landing date, maybe Saturday morning at White Sands, New Mexico. We'll see if it makes it back, okay? I'm guessing that it will. We'll look into that, and we'll definitely report on the success of Starliner next Sunday. Any other comments on this? Okay. NASA's Europa Clipper completed and will be launched October. Another month or so. October 10th is the predicted launch date, and Europa Clipper will be going out to orbit Jupiter, and it'll stay in a Jupiter orbit, but every couple of weeks it will be passing Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. That's one of the ones that they're convinced there's an ocean below the surface. Ice, and they've known that from early pictures, like when Voyager went past it, and they had Galileo in orbit around the planet as well, and they have pictures from that. But now this one is going to have a radar system on board to transmit below the ice and try to get information out of what's below that ice, how deep it is, and all. And that's going to be on these big booms, and I believe it's 80 meters in that area. They'll be transmitting through the ice, and depending on how deep it is, they'll know from the reflection coming back. So it's a large, very large spacecraft. I was looking at 14,000 pounds when it launches. Half of that will probably be fuel, but still, that's still an 8,000-pound vehicle. It's got these massive solar panels on it, and they said around 50 feet on each side, so it's 100 feet long when they open up. After they launch October 10th, once they get into space, one of the first things they're going to do is open up these solar panels. And, around Earth, they would draw a tremendous amount of power, But unfortunately, it's not staying near Earth orbit. It's going to be going to Jupiter. And it won't get there until about 5 years from now. Yeah, 5.5 years. 2030 is the predicted time. And at that point, Jupiter, due to the inverse square law, they do the math, and it comes out to around 4% of the light that you normally get from Earth. So here, these massive solar panels could be able to power a house no problem around Earth. It's only going to be getting around 700 watts at Jupiter. And the 700 watts will be charging batteries, instead of lithium-ion batteries on board. Now, the interesting part of panels when they open up, needed to put these booms, there's actually half a dozen of them, three on one side, three on the other, that need to be extended for these for this radar system and for the 80 meter transmissions. That the phones are going to be, they're like dipoles, but I think there's probably coils in there. Because it's not 134 feet long, but it's around 50 feet long. But they're going to have the, they're going to transmit that down through the ice using these things. They needed to support these big dipole antennas. I mean, they're not wires. These are tubes that are going to be extended. So there's a bit of mass that's involved with this. And they thought about putting it on, you know, some kind of separate boom and all. They wanted to put it attached to the solar panel, so halfway out on the solar panel. So, like, you know, on one side it would be like 25 feet out instead of 50 feet out. You know, halfway out they would have this dipole system that's going to open up. And that's what I'm really interested in, see how that works 5 years from now. And this whole system develops. So we'll see. Launch is going to be on a Falcon Heavy. And like I said, October 10 launch. So, well, we'll see. What is that, about a little over a month now. So, anyway. Any comments on Europa Clipper? I've been talking about this thing for 10 years, since they started talking, eventually going around orbit around Jupiter, and it's not going to be a moon Europa, even so the Europa Clipper. If they did that, it wouldn't last long. Europa is located in a very strong radiation area of Jupiter. So it would, fry the electronics in no time. So what they're going to do is have it orbit Jupiter every couple of weeks. It'll pass Europa very close, pick up all the data, and then it'll go, highly elliptical. It'll get away from the moon, and then at that point it will be able to transmit data back to Earth, again on the X-band like we were talking before. It's kind of like a, 8.5 foot diameter dish, so it'll be able to do that. And radiation, they talked about different radiation boxes for the electronics to use, and they didn't use lead, they used titanium heavy wall, I think it's like 1 inch thick or something. So it's good enough to, for their purposes. And that's going to protect the electronics to some degree. Maybe if they set up lead, maybe they could have had this thing orbit the planet, or orbit the moon. But, of course, these decisions were made many years ago. Any comments? I'm going to drop it and see if anybody's on Echo Link as well. This is WS2R.
Paul, got a question?
Okay, Charlie, just stand by 1 second, please. I just want to see if anybody's on Echo Link. It takes a while for them to get through.
Yes, WD2BX out here. They're spending how many millions of dollars to put an 80-meter rig and dipole into space?
Frank, I don't know. All these things are billion-dollar projects, You know how it is. I don't remember. I've read it in the past, but it's two dipoles. And then another, at least one antenna that's going to pick up the signal from the reflected signal coming back. So they're all long dipoles. So, yeah. We'll see. I mean, it does work. They've done this at other planets, transmit down and watch the reflections coming back to determine how deep something's on, including Earth. You know, there's been satellites that do the same thing at Earth. So they know it's going to work. Back to you, Brian.
Yeah, you know, I was being a little silly, but it just seems kind of funny. Putting an 80-meter radio with a couple of dipoles on this thing and spending millions of dollars to see what happens when they shoot 80-meter signals at the planet. Yeah, and I guess it would be two dipoles probably being used as a phased array to get some directivity toward the planet. I don't suppose they're going to do a test like they did on the Juno mission where they had the... which I think had a 10-meter transponder on it, and they had the hands test it by transmitting up, and then the radio, the transponder sending the signals back down to make sure the thing was working. As far as you know, they're not doing a test like that on this mission, are they?
No, I haven't heard any requests for hands to do that. And I was on the Juno mission, 2013. I got involved with that one. That was I had the launch, and they got a situation where they need to get past Earth to pick up gravity assist. So they orbit the sun, you know, once, and then, you know, anytime they pass Earth, they pick up thousands of miles an hour, and then they eventually can get their way to Jupiter. Now we have Juno, of course, in orbit around Jupiter, but that's going to be a polar orbit where Europa Clipper will be pretty much equatorial. The test that JPL wanted to do, through NASA, was to get as many hands as possible to transmit, like you said, on 10 meters and slow CW. I mean, you push the key down. You really needed a straight key. I used my straight key. And you hold it down for a period of time for a dot, and another dot, another dot. We didn't do dashes. We just said hi, you know. Did it, but each dot was like push the dot, and then you're on a computer at the time, and you know anybody was participating. You know you were on their site, and then it would say you know I think it was a red dot would appear on the screen. You held the thing down until the green one, and then you released it, and that would be a dot, and another dot, and another dot, and then there was a big space, you know, between the two letters of HI. And you know, you waited and waited, and then another red dot would appear, and you did the I. And, anybody that participated eventually would get a QSL card from NASA. And only one other person I knew that, you know, lovely that did that was... LC2OR, she did it as well. And it took, let me drop it a second. It took about 6 to 7 months before we got cards back. Long wait, but eventually, you know, we're used to that. You know, which is not the one that if you're ever going to get the card back. And sure, I have that framed. And what that was a detector. Juno has this detector that, you know, is designed for that, and they said if you transmit it up at 10 meters, this plasma detector would pick it up, and that's what, you know, picked up the dots, you know, the four dots and the two dots, was this plasma detector, you know, they had it turned on for this experiment. And the reason they wanted to do this whole thing is that they wanted to make sure the plasma detector was working okay, and they wanted to see the results before it actually got out to Jupiter, and then when they put it into operation at Jupiter. It's kind of like, you know, calibrating things before it gets there. So that was the deal with that, Frank. Back to you. WS2N.
Yeah, I remember the experiment. I was really surprised that that worked. I don't know why they're not trying something similar with this one. May have to do with the trajectory, or as you said, the dipoles are large, and I guess they can't deploy them until they're pretty far out. So that may be the reason. Anyway, the concept sounds kind of fun, especially since space comms are not commonly done at the low HF frequencies. So in this case, I know they're not actually doing it for communications. It's radar type thing. Anyway, it sounds like an interesting project, though. But we'll all have to be around here in 5 years to see how it goes. Certainly takes a long time to get out there. Anyway, back to that. WB2BX. So.
Yeah, I concur. I'm no kid either, you know. And they had these long duration missions. It didn't sound bad years ago, you know, when they had the Rosetta mission. You know, they said, it's going to take 14 years. And I said, okay, no problem. You know, that came and went, you know. But, yeah, then the same thing now, you know, these are long duration missions. Look how long it took New Horizon to get out of Pluto. And that came and gone. And I even visited a couple of Kuiper objects after Pluto. The time doesn't stop, that's for sure, Frank. And I'm going to have to look to see. They probably do have a plasma detector on board. There's like 10 different instruments, different things that they're going to be doing on this Europa Clipper mission. So, yeah, maybe that's one of them. But if it is, I haven't seen that they're looking for amateurs to do a test like that. And, you know, if there is, it wouldn't be for, let's say, another year. Well, I don't know if, I think this one does also have Earth assist. So it'll go around the sun and pass us again to pick up speed. I didn't see the orbit on it. So maybe in a year or so, I'll have to look for that. Very good, Frank. I'm going to see what Charlie wanted. I know he put his call out there for a second. Charlie, over here, this WS2N. Go ahead.
I had a question about the Advanced Composite Solar System spacecraft. This is solar power putting out current. What kind of current is this thing going to put out?
Yeah, I'm not sure. The Advanced Solar Satellite. I'm missing this one. Is it up there already, or is it launched that I don't know about? Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, it was just put up recently. It's a rocket lab launch NASA solar sail. Okay.
Oh, okay, that one. Yeah, I think that's about the size of a patio. No current, no anything. It's just a solar sail, so it's gonna pick up the light from the sun, and that's what drives it. The little little photons bouncing against the sail. They've done this type of thing before, but you know, it's a good idea for, you know, for future missions. You know, once it gets accelerated, you know, the acceleration won't stop, but the propulsion on it is so small that it's going to take, you know, like virtually forever to, you know, to get up to speed. But they've run a couple of tests with these things before, and then, yeah, this is the latest one that Rocket Lab put up there. So yeah, it's not going to be solar volt tactic. It's not going to be voltage or current. It's just light rays that are going to push this thing along. Solar powered vacuum drive.
Okay, I thought it was for power. I thought they were trying, you know, like a new kind of solar panel.
No, but, you know, they did take that into consideration when they have, you know, these long-duration missions. The one I just talked about, Europa Clipper, or one that's going out to, they call it the Psyche mission, that's going to visit an asteroid in the asteroid belt. You know, to keep these things in precise locations, you know, where they need to be exact. Especially like a mission like Psyche, that has a laser beam that shoots back to Earth, infrared for communication tests. It has to be so exact, and they do take into consideration the movement of the spacecraft, not only, you know, the speed of it, but the orientation of it. So that all has to be calculated and figured, you know, before they run a test like that. But yeah, I mean, they do think about things like that, Charlie.
Hey, now, Elon Musk, he sent up two rockets minutes apart with all those, satellites in it?
Yeah, he got the okay to launch again. Had some problems recently. Like one of the boosters that came down on a ship didn't make it. Wound up leaking fuel or whatever it was, and then the thing blew up on the ship. And the FAA grounded them for a little while until they were able to show what the problem was, that they're going to correct it, and now he's launching again. And yeah, that was two flights. I think one was from Florida and the other one was from Vandenberg, California. And yeah, one of them, they launched those satellites. I think they're up to 6,000 or more satellites. So yeah, we'll see how they do. Yeah, he's back in operation. They did cancel, or delay anyway, the flight of the Polaris mission, where four people are going to be on board. Nothing to do with NASA. It's a private mission billionaire that's paying for it. This guy Jared is doing it, and I was supposed to go a few days ago, but now, you know, that's been delayed because of the shutdown by the FAA, and then they had problems with the weather. They need to save the booster for one when it goes out to the ocean, so they don't have a big ship out there to catch it as it comes down. But the other problem is, in case they have to abort, you know, not only near Florida, which, you know, you could have okay seas near Florida, but do you have okay seas south of Florida, you know, or is it, you know, is there high waves there? Because if they abort, they have to come down, they'd be in trouble if there was rough water. So that's a bit of a delay problem for them, so they haven't gone up yet. And that That is a flight that's going to be a pole flight around the South Pole and North Pole. And one of the goals on that mission is to open up the hatch in the front and float an astronaut out. First EVA by a commercial company with nothing to do with NASA. Spacesuits were all built by SpaceX. And then that guy is going to come back in, and then a woman is going to go out. Gillis, she works for NASA. She works for SpaceX. She's going to do an EVA as well. And I'm not too crazy about the way they're doing it. There's no airlock. So, you know, there's four people that are going to be on the spacecraft. I think I went through this last week. And all four are going to be in a vacuum. They all have the same spacesuits on. And, you know, if anything goes wrong, you know, there won't be, one person around to tell the tales if all four are in trouble. So I'm not crazy about this whole idea. You know, why don't they wait until that Starship is built and that thing's flying on a regular basis to do an EVA? You know, I think they're jumping the gun, but I hope all goes well. Any comment?
No comment. Oh, yes, I did have a comment. You made a mention that, Starlink is coming down Saturday?
Yeah, we went through that a little earlier. And, 12:03, I think. You know, after midnight. And that's if there's no delays. They do need good weather at White Sands, New Mexico. It lands on land. Otherwise, it will drift into the mountains. They don't want that. So, that's the plan for Saturday. And it's getting late, so I just want to mention there's another asteroid hunting spacecraft that's being built that should be launched in 2027. I know Wesley brought the story up about the WISE spacecraft that has been totally decommissioned. They were using that to look for asteroids. Well, this is like going to be a follow-up, although, you know, WISE was not designed especially for asteroid hunting. It had, had the purpose of looking at stars, galaxies and stuff. But they transitioned that spacecraft from that job to looking for asteroids. The time is up. That spacecraft is now decommissioned. Now they have nothing, but there is something that's going to be launched in 2027. 3 years from now, called NEO, the NEO Surveyor, Near Earth Object Surveyor. And that's being handled by NASA, and looking forward to that thing being launched. That's going to be interesting. That's going to go out to the L1 position, Lagrange point 1, million miles away from the Earth, million miles closer, toward the Sun, and it will be orbiting the Sun. And the idea is it's not going to necessarily be looking for asteroids that are coming in from behind, let's say behind Earth. This thing really wants to look for asteroids that are coming from the Sun. When they come from the Sun, in that direction, not from the Sun, but, in the direction of from the Sun, we have trouble seeing that. And before you know it, it's too late, and these things are close to Earth. The survey is going to have a big sunshade on it, protecting it from the Sun. It will be looking in infrared light. Which means it's not going to be looking for pictures. It's going to be looking for a heat signature coming off of an asteroid. So they'll be able to locate, they think, like 90% of any asteroid that's over 400 feet in diameter. So looking forward to NEO survey. and it's getting late, so any other comments before I close? WS1.